Freeburg, WGTD News Time is 8:10. The morning show is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to be previewing for you an amazing film that will be airing on Monday night on the PBS series American Experience, devoted to the first woman to serve as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. That's part two. For part one, we're talking about one of the most famous plays ever written, Shakespeare's Hamlet, the longest of his plays, a play that was enormously popular even in Shakespeare's day, and its popularity has never waned over the intervening years. And we here in southeastern Wisconsin have the relatively rare opportunity to see a performance of Shakespeare's Hamlet, courtesy of the Fleeing Artist Theater Company. Performances at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. Performances that will be tonight, tomorrow night, and also tomorrow afternoon and Sunday afternoon, four performances in all. We have joining us Dylan Roberts, who is directing this production, and Aaron Dillon, who is performing the role of Ophelia. And just for a moment, Alex Metalski joins us as well, who's kind of the guiding light of the Fleeing Artist Theater. Alex, could you just say a quick word about why the company wanted to undertake Hamlet?
Sure thing. We are absolutely excited to perform Hamlet. As you alluded to, it's considered one of the greatest plays of all time, definitely called the greatest play in the English language. We love the play, we love the character, because the character himself of Hamlet is truly an everyman. There are so many pieces and elements to him that are so relatable that every audience member can see a little bit of themselves in Hamlet. And that's primarily why we chose to do it.
Very good. Well, and it's one of those plays that we hear a lot about, even if you're not an aficionado of Shakespeare. You've heard of Hamlet, but most of us have never seen Hamlet on the stage. So this is a relatively rare opportunity, a treat for sure. So Dylan Roberts and Aaron Dillon are going to be joining us for the balance of the interview to talk about this production. Dylan Roberts, how much have you dealt with Shakespeare as a stage director? And before this, have you ever had the opportunity to direct Hamlet?
Well, I've been working with Shakespeare since I was about 18. That was when I had my first opportunity to assistant direct any of Shakespeare's shows. And I've spent almost my entire career working on Shakespeare. as far as directing wise, outside of a mini directing project, when I went to UW Parkside, this is my first time directing Hamlet, although I've acted in it and played the role myself. So a little different experience here, but you know, Shakespeare is my bread and butter. Wow. It's what I pitch to people when I'm pitching to theaters in Chicago, where I'm from and or where I live now. And it's what I've spent the majority of my career doing.
Very good. So what does it feel like to be on the other end of the equation, having acted the role, the title role of Hamlet, and now to be directing the production? How strange is that? Maybe you're used to that kind of experience by now.
Yeah, it's a little different. But, you know, part of being a director is, as one of my mentors once told me, part of being a director is that you get to play every role. And at the same time, you have to let go of playing every role. So, you know, it's as much as Kenneth Motley, who's playing Hamlet, is doing it in a totally different way than I performed it. It still is true to the character and it's true to the show. And that's really all you can ask for from a Hamlet. So for me, I'm just kind of outside of, you know, directing, I suppose. I'm sitting back and just enjoying watching the performance happen at this point.
Terrific. Aaron Dillon, you're going to be performing the role of Ophelia, and we'll get into the specifics of that in just a little bit. But can you tell us more generally what your experience has been thus far in terms of Shakespeare? And is this the first time you're undertaking this particular role?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I actually did The Tempest in high school. I played Ariel. So that was like my first introduction to Shakespeare. And then last year at UW Parkside, I was in the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged, which is I kind of got to experience like a summarized version of a lot of different Shakespeare plays with Dillon, actually, which was very cool. And we actually, the whole second half of the show is Hamlet. So that was really cool trying to see that from like a comedy perspective, which now translates into our version of Hamlet, since a lot of us have been talking about how Hamlet is actually kind of funny rather than just tragedy all the time. Of course, there's dark parts, but this role has been challenging in a very good way, since I've never really played this sort of role before.
Excellent. Dillon Roberts, summarize, if you would, and I really mean capital S, summarize, the plot of Hamlet, which has at its heart, of course, Hamlet's desire for vengeance for the murder of his father. Tell us whatever else you think is important for us to know at this point about the play.
Absolutely. So Hamlet is the story of a young prince who returns home from college or from university, only to find that his father has died. And in the interim time between his father died and when he returned, his mother married his uncle. And then later that night, the ghost of his father appears to visit him and says, "Hey, your uncle murdered me and you have to get revenge." And the rest of the play is Hamlet on a revenge tour, basically.
Something like that, yes. I mentioned in the introduction that this is Shakespeare's longest play, at least in terms of number of words on the page, and I am assuming in terms of sort of duration as well, it's the longest or one of the longest of his plays. Does it present other challenges beyond its sheer length?
Yeah, part of it is, as you mentioned, Hamlet is so famous that whenever you touch it, whenever you go into it, you have to just kind of embrace how famous it actually is. And you have to understand that audiences will inevitably come with some sort of preconceived notion of what Hamlet is, even if they've never seen it before. You know, they have this image of a man holding a skull and saying, "Oh, Yorick, you know, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him." So that's, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges, is how do you tell the story? You know, and going along with that, for so many modern audiences, Shakespeare is this, you know, when you think about Shakespeare, you think, oh, it's going to be challenging, it's going to be difficult to understand, I can't relate to the story. And that is, you know, the as far away from the truth as could possibly be. You know, my job as director is to bring Shakespeare and the characters that he wrote hundreds of years ago to the modern setting and show that for the audience that they not only can they understand what the actors are saying, but also that they will get the story that's being told. And as Alex was mentioning, they'll be able to relate to the lead character in a way that they probably didn't think they could going into it.
The other lead character, of course, besides Hamlet, is Ophelia. Aaron Dillon, explain to us, first of all, in just a nutshell, who Ophelia is and how she figures into the basic plot of this play.
So Ophelia is the daughter of Polonius, who is a very close family friend of the king and Hamlet's family. So she becomes Hamlet's girlfriend and is the sister of the person who actually fights Hamlet at the end. And she just gets thrown around this whole play.
You have one of the most famous of mad scenes. Tell us what events precipitate that.
Yeah, so first Hamlet starts going a little crazy since his father passed, and he decided to make this facade of himself to be crazy. So he comes to me and is just nothing I've ever seen from him before. So I'm very taken back and I'm hurt, and this happens a few times as well. And then he ends up killing my father, who he thought was going to be his uncle, the king. So everything combined just kind of makes her break. And all of the things that she's been trying to hold together just crumbles.
What is it like to perform a scene like that? What kind of a challenge has it presented to you?
It's been a big challenge, definitely. I want to make her... You know, I want to give her justice for all the things that she's been through, and not overdo it or make her seem like ingenuine at all. But at the same time, she's gone through so much to just fall apart. And it takes a toll on my emotions. Definitely. I definitely cry on stage for reals because I'm just feeling all this hurt that she's feeling.
Wow. Dillon Roberts, as director, give us your perspective on this challenging scene and the guidance that you have given Aaron in order to portray it.
Yeah, you know, playing any mad scene is incredibly difficult, but, you know, Aaron is doing an amazing job with it. And one of the things that I told her when we started is that when you play mad, you're not actually mad. In your own mind, you are completely sane. So even though the words on the page may seem, you know, completely backwards from what the character would be doing in that situation. I mean, and in this scene, at one point, Ophelia calls for a coach, and she's in the middle of, you know, talking with the queen and they're, you know, inside. So, but the way to embrace it is just you have to be true to whatever line is being said at that moment. You have to be true to the character. So even if to the outside world it might seem insane, you have to find that kernel of truth to your character in that exact moment.
Wow. In other words, it would be a mistake for the actor to act insane. I mean, their notion of what it means to be insane, that really doesn't make sense, because that character themselves does not believe themselves to be insane in that moment. So
exactly. It goes back to, you know, something that we always talk about with actors who have to play drunk on stage, that you don't play drunk, you play that you're not drunk. Because when you are actually drunk in real life, you're trying to prove to everyone outside of yourself that, hey, I am sober as can be.
So in addition to the specific challenges for these formidable roles like Hamlet and Ophelia, of course, there are plenty of challenges with any character in Shakespeare for actors who have scant or limited experience. And I suppose even for actors who have done a fair amount of Shakespeare, there's still things about it that are challenging in terms of fully bringing it to life and making it seem fully authentic. In terms of your cast for this particular production and these performances this weekend, how wide a range of experience are we talking about? And what have you been working hardest on in terms of bringing everybody into kind of a similar level of confidence and comfortable assurance with the idiom of Shakespeare?
Yeah, absolutely. The experience is across the board. We have some people who have acted professionally in Shakespeare productions in Chicago and in Wisconsin, but we also have people who have, you know, not done it ever. So, you know, the key as a director is just to help the actors understand that even though the language that they're speaking isn't what we would normally speak, the emotions, the feelings, the scenes, the everything that's happening in the show is real and is something that happens in modern life. I mean, very few of us can relate to being a prince or a king, but the base fact of someone wronging us or the someone betraying us or, you know, or in Ophelia's case, someone, you know, verbally and harassing or insulting us is something that we can all relate to in our own lives. So we have to embrace just the base aspects of the story and not necessarily focus on like, oh, this language is so hard. It's what's the intention behind the language, because French is a hard language too, but for French speakers, it's normal. And it's the same with Shakespeare. You know, when Shakespeare wrote these plays, he wasn't writing them for the court necessarily. He was writing them so that everyone could understand them. And everyone spoke that way, maybe not as poetically as Shakespeare wrote, but they would walk into it from, you know, from the people who would pay a penny to the people who would pay more than that. You know, they would walk into it and enjoy the show. And that's why Hamlet was so popular, because it speaks to everyone across the board.
How large a cast is involved in Hamlet?
Only 9 actors. Hmm. And I say only 9 because Hamlet usually has 14 to 17 characters in it. But we have almost everyone in the show is playing multiple roles, even if that role just includes Ghost.
And was that a directorial choice on your part?
Yeah, absolutely. Going into it, I kind of wanted to make this a lean and mean production. So, you know, I wanted to embrace the creativity of having actors play multiple roles. And it's something that I always enjoy doing. And I feel like it builds a really nice ensemble atmosphere in rehearsals as well.
Very good. Erin Dillon, again, our Ophelia. So, of course, you're not yet to the point of performances. The opening night is tonight. But when you get through a run through, full rehearsal of Hamlet, what do you feel like? Are you drenched, an empty shell? Energized and ready to take on the world? I mean, what does performing the role of Ophelia feel like as you reach the end of this daunting play?
It's kind of heavy, you know, I kind of feel a little exhausted, but I also feel empowered because I just want to do her justice. And I know how deeply she's feeling about everything that's going on. So I feel like she herself is exhausted. And I do feel exhausted at the end, but in a good way, you know, where I feel like I've spent my time and my energy on these people that I care about.
Exhaustion can be happy exhaustion or grateful exhaustion. And I'm sure you feel grateful for the opportunity to do a role like this.
Absolutely.
Very good. So we want to remind everyone that the Fleeing Artists Theater Company is presenting 4 performances of Shakespeare's Hamlet this weekend. Tonight at 7:30, tomorrow afternoon at 2, tomorrow night at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon at 2. So 4 performances in all. Again, these performances at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. And I believe tickets can be purchased at the door. and they're being careful about physical distancing of the audience to keep everybody safe. Are your actors going to be masked or are they unmasked?
Actors will be unmasked for the performance when they're on stage. When they're backstage, they will be masked. And we have been masking in rehearsals up until this week.
Very good. Well, people will certainly appreciate the opportunity to see the expressive faces of all of your cast, including Erin Dillon in the role of Ophelia, and in the director's chair, Dylan Roberts. It was great to speak with both of you. Best wishes to you and everybody involved in Hamlet this weekend, and thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Great. Thank you so much, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's morning show, we want to talk about a really amazing film that is going to be airing this coming Monday evening on PBS as part of the series American Experience. An amazing film about an amazing woman with a very important legacy that many of us probably do not begin to fully appreciate. It is a documentary about Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve as a justice on the United States Supreme Court. The first and not the last. And someone who served on the Supreme Court at a time when America was going through all kinds of wrenching divisions, divisions that by no means have vanished today. We sometimes forget, though, about the sharply divided state of our nation back in the 1980s through the 90s and so on. And many of the cases that came before the U.S. Supreme Court were right at the heart of some of the most bitter divides in our country. And the story of Sandra Day O'Connor, who for so many years was seen as kind of the tiebreaker, the tipping point, the person who, in a sense, would decide many of these questions and important cases, was probably, is a fascinating story in and of itself. But the film goes beyond that to tell the story of who she was, what drew her into the world of law, and some of her early experiences that probably helped shape the way she saw the world and the world of law and her role on our country's highest court. Again, this film is going to be airing on Monday evening, and I'm very, very privileged to speak with the co-producer, writer, and director of the film, Michelle Ferrari. Michelle Ferrari, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
And I just realized in my extensive notes, having watched the film last night, I failed to mark down exactly what the title is. What is the film titled?
Sandra Day O'Connor, The First.
The First. Very good. Was this your idea or someone else's idea for a film to be done about Sandra Day O'Connor?
I must confess that it was someone else's idea. American Experience had optioned the book upon which the film is based, which is sort of our title reversed. It's called The First, Sandra Day O'Connor, and that's by Evan Thomas. And when I was finishing up my last film, The Vote, they brought this idea to me. But I was thrilled, as always, to be working on it. I was, of course, aware of Sandra Day O'Connor when she was nominated to the Supreme Court. I was at an age when I was sort of just becoming aware of the wider world. And certainly in the decades that followed, I followed court decisions that I took an interest in, but I didn't know anything about her personally. And, that's one of the great gifts and privileges of my job. You start a project knowing next to nothing about a person or an event, and by the end of the project, I wouldn't say you're an expert, but you can at least carry on a cogent conversation with an expert, and that's really incredibly rewarding.
The film begins with news footage as she is arriving for her confirmation hearings, and then there is an excerpt from an interview in which she's talking to, I forget if it's Charlie Rose or somebody else, but she kind of takes him to task, somewhat good-naturedly, for how he and others in the media were actually spending way too much time
in a sense, talking about her or talking about matters other than the heart of the matter as far as she was concerned. I think that's a really great way to open the film because it gives us a little peek inside who she was, how she thought, and the way she expressed herself, which was certainly very engaging. Tell us more about this little moment that we see right at the outset of your film.
Well, I will say that even before I read Evan's book, I watched that Charlie Rose interview, and I was just captivated by her. I loved her dry wit and the way she resisted any attempt to interpret or spin her experience. I felt like her personal attributes, her charm, her social intelligence were really on full display, and I knew I wanted to weave that interview in and out of the film. And that moment in particular that you're referencing, she is indeed taking Rose and the rest of the media to task for paying far too much attention to her. I mean, she was certainly aware that her appointment was symbolic, that it, you know, meant a great deal to women, particularly in the legal profession. But she really wanted to get down to the work at hand, and she wanted to be known for the work that she did on the bench and the sort of moniker of the first woman on the Supreme Court, I think, became heavy for her to carry after a certain point. You know, and of course, it was a big deal. She was the first woman in 191 years to sit on the Supreme Court. So, of course, the media was going to pay attention, but she wanted to get on to business.
Right. She's called at one point in the film the most talked about judicial nominee in American history, at least up to that point. And your film reminds us that there was actually gavel-to-gavel televised coverage of her confirmation hearings, which I don't believe had ever happened before. And your film also shows us, and this is also towards the beginning, that there were ferocious protests against her and her nomination at that point in time. I mean, she hadn't even yet sat on the bench or rendered a single decision, but there was already widespread concern from a certain swath of the public in terms of Sandra Day O'Connor taking this position on the U.S. Supreme Court. So there is a lot that is swirling around her at this moment in her life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, first of all, she was the most talked about judicial nominee in history in part because her hearings were televised. And the hearings were televised in part because she was a woman and there was a lot of interest around the issue, but also because of the new medium of cable news. So there was just a lot of coverage of her confirmation in a way that there hadn't been before. I mean, we're accustomed now to seeing these confirmation hearings on television, but that was an entirely new thing. And then the protest that you speak of, it was certainly adamant. I would say at that point it was relatively contained. It came from a faction, what was then a small faction of the Republican Party, far to the right, and, you know, deeply opposed to many of the decisions that had been made by the Warren Court under Earl Warren, liberal decisions, in particular Roe v. Wade. But in 1981, I wouldn't say that that faction had a stranglehold on the party quite yet.
Your film explores her background, being raised in rural Arizona, and the point is made that one really learns self-reliance when you grow up in a place like that. And, of course, self-reliance ends up being one of the hallmarks of her personality. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. She grew up on a 160,000-acre cattle ranch in southeastern Arizona, and for the first many years of her life, she was the only child around. So it was her and her parents and the ranch hands. And she learned very early on to look after herself and to chip in. Everybody had their part to play on the ranch. And at one point she was tasked, when she was about 14 or 15 years old, with bringing lunch to the ranch hands who were out working the roundup. And she and her mother prepared the lunch, and she loaded it into the Willie's Jeep, which she had learned to drive as soon as she could see over the dashboard. And she drove out alone onto this, you know, untracked, unpaved, untenanted ranch and got a flat tire and had to change the tire herself and got to the roundup quite late, the meeting spot quite late. And, you know, she was proud of herself for having changed the tire. And when her father said, "You're late," she said, "Well, Dad, I got a flat tire and I fixed it." And he said, "Next time, leave earlier." And I think the message from, you know, that very early part of her life was that you're responsible and you have to take responsibility. And if it's on your plate, you have to finish it.
We're talking to Michelle Ferrari, writer, producer, director of the American Experience film, Sandra Day O'Connor, The First, which is airing this coming Monday night. She was exceptionally intelligent, skipped two grades of school, enrolled at Stanford at the age of 16, and ultimately went to law school. Ultimately there met and married John O'Connor, who was also a lawyer. And their marriage was uncommon in a lot of different ways. And chances are Sandra Day O'Connor, for as brilliant as she was, would not have gone on to do what she did had she not had a life partner like John O'Connor. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but can you just say a quick word about their marriage and their partnership, life partnership, and what a difference that made in terms of what she was ultimately able to achieve?
I think it made an enormous difference, as you said. Certainly, when they married in the early 1950s, you know, women's roles were fairly prescribed, and most men of their class would have expected their wives to stay home and raise the children and take care of the house. But they had a relationship of equals, and John was very, very aware of how gifted Sandra was, and he supported her in whatever she wanted to do, to the extent that when she was confirmed to the Supreme Court, he essentially gave up his work for hers.
She, for a time, left the law, in part because of the frustration of not having the kind of vibrant legal career that her smarts and credentials warranted. But it was, I guess, a time when it was quite uncommon for women to be lawyers. And so maybe that was part of why she, for a time, went into politics. I mean, was actually in her state legislature. Tell us what you think is the significance of this relatively brief chapter in her life and career.
You know, I wouldn't think of it, or wouldn't say that she left the law. She wanted to be a lawyer in the Senate. She was interested in state government. She'd become quite involved with the Republican Party at that point. She'd been a precinct committee person and had a lot of connections in the Republican Party. And I think she was just interested in how the law and the legislature, you know, intersected. She wanted to have that experience. She was a very curious person, and she had this opportunity. She had Republican connections. There was an open seat vacated midterm, and she kind of got herself appointed to that seat. I think, you know, she really learned a lot about people and getting things done when she was in the Arizona Senate. And she was a very effective negotiator and very well liked by her peers on both sides of the aisle. I think that really kind of molded the kind of justice she would become on the Supreme Court. Mm.
One of the things I especially appreciate about your film is how it takes us back to the days of the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, which, of course, ultimately did not come to be. And Sandra Day O'Connor was caught right in the middle of that very, very hotly contested a division in our country. And she makes a decision about, in a sense, letting ERA die in the state of Arizona, just believing that there was that was its destiny anyway. But she went about accomplishing other things that would have perhaps happened with ERA in her own way. Explain what she goes about doing with the laws of the state of Arizona from that point on.
As any one of her biographers would probably tell you, you know, what she does is very Sandra Day O'Connor, which is to say she kind of makes an end run around the fractious politics, the backlash against the ERA, the fact that she doesn't have sufficient votes in her caucus to get the measure to, out of committee. And instead, she just goes through the statutes in Arizona and one by one targets each of the ones that treat women unequally and gets those laws changed. Winds up leaving Arizona women in a more equal position than they would have been without her presence, certainly, and brings to them many of the legal protections that the ERA would have had it passed.
The question is posed more than once in your film of whether or not Sandra Day O'Connor was a feminist, and the label was something from which she recoiled a bit. But the answer to that seemingly simple question is a little bit complicated, and what you were just talking about is kind of folded into that, isn't it?
I mean, I think there's no question that she was a feminist in the sense that, you know, she believed that no one should be prevented from doing what they were capable of doing by virtue of their gender or race, for that matter, or she didn't really care for boxes. She didn't like the idea of people being put into boxes. But she did not identify as a feminist, in part as one of her former clerks, her very first clerk on the Supreme Court, actually says in the film, in part because she saw feminists as people who were protesting in the street, and that's not who she was. She was, you know, a much more sort of moderate, measured person. And she didn't live in the world of bra burning, although we know no bras were burned, but still. I think she just didn't want to associate herself with that kind of radical action.
Explain why there was such ferocious concern from some over her nomination to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, by the time we get to 1981, the backlash against Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that, you know, guaranteed a right to abortion, was really picking up steam. In 1976, John Paul Stevens was unanimously confirmed to the Supreme Court without being asked a single question about abortion. But by 1981, we're in a place where the backlash is mounting, the forces are gathering in opposition, the pro-life movement is gaining ground and gaining political power. And they really made a big noise about O'Connor's nomination, in part because she had signaled her support for the Equal Rights Amendment early on in Arizona before withdrawing it when she realized she would have to expend too much political capital. And then also she had cast an unrecorded vote to decriminalize abortion in Arizona. And this was regarded as, evidence that she was at least tolerant of abortion, if not in favor of it. And, you know, the pro-life faction of the Republican Party had basically supported Ronald Reagan on the premise that he would appoint anti-abortion judges to the court. So O'Connor was seen as anathema. But as I said before, you know, the divisions hadn't really solidified yet, and the pro-life movement was, the Christian conservatives were yet a faction of the Republican Party. And so even though they made a big noise, it wound up being something of a tempest in a teapot, and O'Connor was confirmed unanimously. No one wanted to cross the new president. There was too much to be done.
Your film suggests at least one possible reason why Ronald Reagan had pledged to nominate a woman to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. Explain what at least part of his reason very likely was.
Well, you know, in keeping with all of this backlash and the rise of the Christian right, et cetera, the Republican Party had really done kind of an about-face in 1980 at their nominating convention, which is to say that they had been the first party to endorse the Equal Rights Amendment and had long had a kind of open policy about Roe v. Wade, about abortion rights. And at the 1980 convention, they withdraw support for both, formally dismiss the Equal Rights Amendment and make this pledge to appoint anti-abortion judges at all levels. And they had real concern, Reagan's team had real concern, that they were going to lose the votes of college-educated women in the bargain. And he was down, and Reagan was down in the polls with women in the swing state of Illinois, for example. And so he made this kind of literally campaign bust decision to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court, to nominate a woman to the Supreme Court, and announced that he would do so if elected president. And it was a pretty cynical move, I think, at the time. But very soon after taking office, he had a chance to do just that because a justice retired. And Sandra Day O'Connor's name was already on a list because she was, by that point, quite well-connected.
Right. And, of course, she is confirmed. She does take her place on the U.S. Supreme Court, the first woman in our history. And moreover, and I guess this is in so many ways kind of the central point of your film, is that although we should not underestimate the significance of a woman at last, at long last, sitting on the Supreme Court, in a sense, what is far more significant is not her gender, but the role that she ends up playing on the Supreme Court during some very tumultuous years when she is seen as the pivotal figure on that case. One headline says she was calling the shots. Another headline calls it the O'Connor Court. Just explain the dynamics of what was going on there that made her so significant.
Well, as the court itself became more polarized, she increasingly was holding the center of gravity. Over the course of her tenure, the ideological fault lines in this country began to solidify and harden. But O'Connor was always a person who could see nuance, who looked for nuance. And I think, you know, I was both impressed and intrigued by her style on the bench, by her vision of the court's role in American life, and her penchant, I would say even her gift, for building consensus, which increasingly seems to me a lost art. But she was the swing vote, and she did not cling to any fixed ideological notions. And as a result, she was able to kind of broker consensus among her peers, so that the law did not swing wildly in one direction or another. I have nothing but respect for revolutionaries, you know, for people who are willing to go to extremes in defense of a principle or a vision for the future. But I also think that in a nation of nearly 300 million people, there's a real need for compromise, for people who pull toward the middle. I think, you know, most Americans, at least not when not faced with a stark either-or choice, tend to see those complexities themselves, tend to see the complexities of some of our sort of more controversial issues, and tend to be moderate. And I think O'Connor was a justice in that mold.
Right. And for many years, she sat on a Supreme Court in which there were four staunch conservatives and four staunch liberals, and there she sat in the middle. I mean, willing and able to pivot between them. And at one point in your film, there's a really kind of neat graphic as we're taken through various cases before the Supreme Court, and we're shown visually with whom Justice O'Connor voted. And in certain cases, it was with those conservatives. In other cases, it was with the liberals. And you had a long succession of 5-4 decisions. And in essentially every case, it is Sandra Day O'Connor who decides which direction it goes. It's such an important part of her extraordinary legacy. A last quick question. She, of course, she is still alive, but in her early 90s. Were you able to directly connect with her in any way in the making of this film?
Sadly, I was not. I did not have the privilege of meeting her or talking to her. She has, you know, officially retired from public life. But I was very fortunate to speak with her son, Scott, and I, you know, spent a great many hours watching interviews with her and footage of her, much of which is in the film, and did feel that I came to know her in some small way, and hope that audiences feel similarly.
I certainly do after watching the film, and I appreciate the contributions of everyone who is in this film, including her son, who offers wonderful testimony, shall we say, to what she was like as a wife, mother, human being, and a very significant Supreme Court justice. The film, again, is Sandra Day O'Connor, The First, and it will air Monday night on the PBS series American Experience. And the director, producer, co-writer of the film, Michelle Ferrari. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and congratulations on a marvelous film.
Thank you so much, Greg. A pleasure to be here.
This weekend, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, you will hear two different interviews related to 9/11. Tomorrow, Kevin Dwyer, reporter for The New York Times and co-author of the book 102 Minutes, which tells the extraordinary story of how thousands of people managed to escape the Twin Towers on 9/11. On Sunday, you'll hear the interview which I recorded just a couple of months after 9/11, with Jan Shogren, an officer with the Salvation Army, who was on the scene as a so-called frontline relief worker, offering aid to those directly impacted by the terrorist attack. On Monday's Morning Show, you'll hear my interview with William Langvish, who was responsible for three extraordinary articles for Atlantic Monthly called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center, which chronicles the incredible story of what it took, the courage, the relentless energy and innovation it took to clear away that terrible tangle of debris, that gigantic mountain of debris left by the collapse of those Twin Towers. A really remarkable story, which you'll hear on Monday. On Tuesday, Reed Forgrave, the author of a book called Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. He got to know the family of one Zach Easter, a young man who unfortunately began suffering from the effects of CTE, which ultimately led to his suicide. A very important story. On Wednesday, Adam Larson, who is a seasonal park ranger at the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park in Church Creek, Maryland. September happens to be Underground Railroad Month, and we will hear all about that important legacy. Next Thursday, Jim Ripley from Carthage talks about the first band concert.